There's a very, very little appreciated scene in the very first chapter of the Gospel, of the Bible, the book of Genesis. The story, the first story of creation, the seven-day account. On the sixth day, after God had made everything, we're told that God paused and looked at everything he had created and pronounced it not just good, but very good. And Tom Weston, a priest in the program whose tapes are extraordinary, he's out of Berkeley, who understands a little bit of Hebrew, says that the word here is a sort of like a wholeness. God pronounces everything very whole. Everything is exactly how it should be. Everything. This is the end of creation. And that includes the full person. That includes woman, man, mankind, humanity, which includes, therefore, our bodies, which includes, in a very, very real way, all the feelings that you and I have. I told you last night that philosophically, in our history at times, people have seen the body as evil, and that's why the ban on cremation came, and how today most of us don't really see the body this way, and that's why the ban on cremation could be removed. Unfortunately, in America, in Missouri, in 1989 and 1990, in the circles in which you and I live, emotions are very clearly seen as evil for a variety of reasons. And that clearly includes those of us who are in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not that sure about the other fellowships, but very, very much so in AA. Let me outline for you some of the obstacles that I will have today feeling my feelings. And the very first is, I just use his name, I was born in John Wayne's America. And John Wayne doesn't cry. I mean, you just can't see. John Wayne is sort of just, he's a picture of the, what not just man, but macho man, but even woman is supposed to be. We're supposed to be so flat, so even, and we're just not supposed to be ruled by our feelings. John Wayne would just really never be. It's not macho to cry. It's not macho to grieve. I want to tell you something. Remember John 11 and read it someday. I think I will refer to it one other time. Jesus cries when his friend dies. And we're told first, the English clears up the reality. The Greek says he had a grief that went to his bowels. And then it says, and the English in the King James is a mistranslation. It can't capture what the Greek verb says. It says he entered a state of continued weeping where the stress is on the fact that he cried and 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 it goes on. He didn't cry and get it over with. And then we're told, moved deeply again when he goes back to the tomb. And biblically, the number three stands for repetition. He cries deeply, he cries consistently, and he goes right on crying. Trying not to grieve, thinking that it's macho not to have to cry, is trying to be stronger than we're supposed to be. I will use Jesus in this, since this retreat is being given in Christian context. I don't want to use it too strongly so that people who might listen to the tape or those of you who aren't Christian won't get turned off by it, but because I always want to come into some other areas. I think I have shared with you for about the last year and a half I've been in therapy for what I call my codependent issues. It stalled, and just I'm really going to get it from my therapist because I'm missing an appointment this week. It'll be three in a row I'm missing. But I discovered through the therapy, and I was completely unaware of this, I'm 52 years old, as I've told you, I do not have a single memory of ever crying. So I was shut down somewhere around the age of 1 and 2. And as I shared at the ACA meeting here, the one memory I have is my mother saying, you cry and I'll give you something to cry about. Now, I also learned then from this that my shutdown goes deeper. Not only can I not cry, I really don't have the right to feel sorry for myself. When I try to look at areas in my life that aren't perfect and to grieve over myself, I can't do it. The closest I'll come to tears is a scene on television or in the movies if I see a father loving a son. Breaking Away, if you saw the movie, when the dad took his son and had the good talk on the college campus. That's as close as I've come to crying that I'm aware of in my life. I won't cry for sorrow, ever. I stood at my granddad's grave and felt nothing and thought it was bad of me doing this. I know today that I don't have a drinking alcoholic, but I have the traits of an adult child. I'm a codependent. And thank goodness I've done the reading. And one of the characteristics of being codependent is I shut down my feelings. And I don't feel. So first we have the John Wayne picture. It's just not macho for man, for woman in America to be emotional. We look at Russians greeting each other and hugging, and or Frenchmen greeting each other and hugging and kissing. And we don't like that. I mean, there's something wrong about that. We see the Arabs in Lebanon crying, weeping and screaming and sobbing and throwing themselves on graves. And we don't think that's healthy. Actually, both of those are far, far, far healthier, if you know anything about human psychology, than what we do. In the short run and in the long run. Secondly, and this is why I said I don't know how you, those of you who are not in AA, will view this. A lot of AAs have real trouble feeling their feelings because of what I would hope is the misunderstanding of some of the things in Alcoholics Anonymous. A little bit of background first. Alcoholics Anonymous is not the same across the country in even like its setup. There's two basic approaches. I'd almost say like New York and California. And my state splits. Oklahoma City and Tulsa are not alike in anything, in politics, in religion, and in AA. New York AA is, I think, what you have mostly in the area here, where most of the meetings are in hospitals and churches and schoolrooms. California AA basically isn't like that. Southern California. Southern California AA has most of the meetings in clubhouses. That's the kind of AA I grew up in. Oklahoma City, a town of, and Tulsa are about the same size. Oklahoma City has 10 to 12 different clubhouses, and 95% of the meetings that occur will occur in those clubhouses. I sobered up in a town of 100,000 people. We have five clubhouses, one meeting that I know of a week that doesn't occur in a clubhouse. So you get a different kind of spirit. Anyway, when the AAs have a clubhouse where the meetings are, you get all the banners up and all the little signs and all the slogans. And one of the things that is very common is you get a list of assets and debits or vices and virtues. They always upset me. They're wrong. They shouldn't be there ever. Because saying something is an asset or a debit depends upon an experience of God. And how can I say that you have a right to experience God as you experience God and put a list of what's right and wrong on a board? One of the things that I've seen on, I'll give you an example of this, on that board is they'll put profanity as a debit. I don't agree with that at all. Not at all. First, if you're a Christian, Jesus gave us a standard. He said, love is the standard by which you tell whether anything is good or bad. A new command I give you, a new standard, love one another as I have loved you. Now, if I lost my temper in mass, I don't like children, and I'm in a parish, all three of my parishes are exceptionally small, they're country parishes, 100 people in one, 180 in the second, and about 30 in the third. One service, no cry room, I got screaming kids at all my services. It's like God's just giving it to me. And my people know I don't like kids. See, I've learned I can have my feelings. I don't kick kids. When I see a child, I want to kick them. I don't kick kids. I can control the actions. And once I saw I want to kick kids and became aware of the actions, I can deal with kids a lot better. I don't have a struggle going on within me. I see the feeling, and I control the action, and I act better. But supposing I lost my cool. This past Sunday, some of you know Chip and Michelle. Chip came down to spend the weekend with me, and I had a friend coming to a service, and I really wanted everything to go well. And I got twins. This is God's sick sense of humor. This couple lived in another town, had twins, and the next month moved into my parish. And when one of them screams, the other screams. I got two screaming kids minimally. And they were in the best form they've ever been in. They screamed all through the sermon. Now, supposing I had lost my cool and looked at the mother and said, would you get that little bastard out of this church? That is using language unnecessarily to badly hurt someone. That's wrong. There's no way Jesus would want that in any form at all. But when a bunch of guys are talking in high school, there's no hurt or, it's just the language, and it's neutral. I will give you an instance where I believe a woman learned to curse as an act of love. During Vietnam, a friend of mine was employed for a walk-in drug clinic for street addicts, the hippies and everybody else. She was sober, she was clean, she was raised society, and she was never taught to curse. Now, she had to learn to just roll the MFs off her tongues as if they were the most natural thing in the world, to talk the language of the people in order to help them. To bring them to God, she had to talk first their language and then bring them to the program and could bring them to God. I don't think anybody was being hurt by what she was saying. I think her profanity was an act of love. It was learning a language to bring people to God. So I don't think you can put an arbitrary list on a board. But we do have these lists, and unfortunately, they all will include some version of fear and anger, which says right up there in black and white, if you have fear, if you experience the feeling of fear, you have a debit, you have a vice. If you experience the feeling of anger, you have a debit, you have a vice. And even worse, the big book says that anger and fear are deadly. In chapter 5, they're two of the things the big book spotlights to be inventory. And so alcoholics often will reason this way, and I watch this happening. Anger is deadly to an alcoholic. I'm an alcoholic, and so I can't afford to be angry, therefore I will not be angry. And they just stuff their anger. They miss what the big book really says. The big book says, I am as powerless over our anger as I am over liquor. It's in that same section. I cannot not be angry. And I try to tell people this. The only thing worse for an alcoholic than being angry is not to be angry. Because if you're not angry, if I'm not angry, almost inevitably I'm stuffing the feeling. And a stuffed feeling, a feeling that I push down, will run me. I see that happen time after time. People living this rosy plane and they're watching the anger just churn around in here. I talked once about how healthy I believe it is to be angry at God. And this woman, well, you could just touch the hate in her voice. Talked about how she would never get angry at God and everything was good and she thought she was terminally ill at this moment. And you could just feel that she more than anything needed to sit down and scream her anger out at God the way Job did so that she could know some peace. What the big book says that I do with anger is recognize it, write about it, analyze it, and then start praying for God to remove it. The big book says anger is bad, but I'm powerless over it. So then the big book gives me a series of techniques that in the past have helped people handle their anger. The 12 and 12 adds on to this because it says that justified anger is the luxury of other people. So there's this stream of thought in AA that kind of warns alcoholics, don't be angry, and then alcoholics will figure the feelings are wrong. John Wayne, AA, Christianity seems to say that some of our emotions are evil. On the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew chapter 5 or 6, I don't know what part of it is, Jesus says that if you're angry at your brother in your heart, that's as bad as killing him. So feeling anger is as bad as killing someone. He says, if you lust after someone in your heart, that's as bad as fornication. So the feeling of lust is as bad as the action. The conclusion from this again is that the feeling itself is a sin. And countless people come to confession and confess feelings. And it isn't a time for long instruction, and it just hurts the hell out of me what they're not understanding. They're confessing is a sin, something God sees as precious. Not only not as evil or neutral, but as good. People miss the point that if you read the Gospel of Mark, you're very clearly told that Jesus became angry at the Pharisees. If anger is a sin, then Jesus sinned. If Jesus became angry, one of two things, either Jesus sinned or anger is not a sin. He doesn't have an exception. You know, it's not anger is a sin for all of us, but he could do it. He became fully human. And he very clearly marks the gospel that allows Jesus to become so human. We need it. He becomes flustered. He sighs with exasperation. I don't know what the hell I'm going to do with these. What the hell? Maybe a good term. I don't know what the heaven I'm going to do with these Pharisees. That'd probably be his way of saying it. I mean, he can feel these human feelings. He is fully man. And I want to talk about this a moment. That's the heart of Christianity. He becomes like us in everything but sin. If Jesus didn't experience anger, then he's not like us. If Jesus didn't experience fear, then he's not like us. If Jesus didn't experience lust, then he's not like us. And that's very crucial. You know, if Jesus never looked at a woman and felt an urge of lust, I don't know what he was, but he wasn't human. Whatever term you use. And what we're doing is we're creating an artificial plastic figure and saying, this is what he was like. When he walked down the streets of Jerusalem and it was 110 in the shade, if he perspired, he had the odor of sanctity. And when he was a little baby in swaddling clothes, he certainly didn't soil those at all. I mean, because it just wouldn't be nice for him to do. And he certainly never, and pardon me, I hope I don't offend you, but I believe this is crucial. He certainly never had an erection, a spontaneous one. Well, I don't know what you got when you take those things out, but whatever it is, it's not like any man. And if you took the erection out and just made some substitutions, not like any woman that you ever know. So if that's the kind of Jesus you got, you don't have a Jesus who is man. And that, incidentally, was one of the first two great heresies of the church. People couldn't believe the love of God could totally unite with the weakness of man. And so what they said was Jesus was a dream, an image, like when God appeared to Abraham. He looked like a man, but he wasn't really. It was like a fantasy in our world. And that's all he was. And the church condemned that. He was fully man in everything. I personally believe 95% of the Catholics that I know, most of the Christians I know, today actually live that early heresy. They've adopted it. Their God is not real in any form. What is sin? If God is love and Jesus gave us the standard, then sin is acting against love. It is acting to hurt someone. It's not a feeling. My feeling of anger, that urge, that instinct that comes, does not hurt me or anyone else. If it did, then it would be sinful. Acting on the feeling or nursing the feeling can hurt me or someone else. That's wrong. And a loving God doesn't want me to do this. Now, I bring this up. I don't like getting up here in thought. If I talk about something, I hope it's going to be because it's important. The reason I bring this one up about Jesus is there's a rather important conclusion. Whatever Jesus cannot be, he cannot love in me. And that will go to the heart even of what we're talking about. If Jesus can't sweat, then Jesus won't have anything to do with my sweat. If Jesus somehow never had any toilet functions, and my God certainly in no way will love Larry's toilet functions. If Jesus never had just a natural, spontaneous, non-lusting erection, and my God cannot love the sex part of my life. And you know what I got to do? I got to become a religious schizophrenic. And that's what most Christians are. God doesn't love me. God loves my good traits, but whatever they are, they're not Larry, because Larry's a whole. It is absolutely crucial somehow that we allow, that I allow my God to be fully man. That I believe that Jesus had love and anger as feelings. That he had joy and fear. That he experienced frustration. That he had a desire in him to be possessive and control. So that he knows what these are like. He experienced the agony of real temptation. How could he be tempted if he didn't have the feelings? What's a temptation if he's just sailing above it all? Oh, I'm going to pretend I'm hungry. I'm going to pretend I want to control the whole universe and have everybody just kind of react to me. I'll just pretend that. But I'm not really feeling any strong urges in here because that wouldn't be nice. I believe this is very, 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 very crucial. If Jesus loves, won't become these negatives, if Jesus didn't have these feelings and he won't love them in me, Jesus is just like my shame-based parents, loving me for my good parts, but not loving me for who I am. And religion is reinforcing my sickness, not coming to the help of my cure. And I think that's the kind of God most people have, exactly like their shame-based parents. And let's come on to that one right now. So we have John Wayne, we have AA, we have Christianity, all telling us our feelings are bad. And on top of that, we've had our parents. This is the real thing. This is what many of us grew up with. And I'm not blaming them. I'm describing my parents. They had the same kind of parenting. The only model they had was the model they lived, and it's the model they gave me, and it was a model of conditional love. I know very much that for their own weaknesses, my mother, certainly, lacked an inner sense of worth, an inner sense of peace, and an inner sense of serenity. And so she needed good children for a variety of reasons. Because if her children were real and had real feelings, it would upset her. And if her children were real and not perfect, it would make her look like a bad mother and hurt her image. So I was not loved ever that I'm aware of for who I am. I was loved for how I acted. And my mother couldn't stand me rebelling in her presence. I mean, that's just even impossible for me to picture today, standing and screaming anger at my mother. That just can't be done. So I was totally rejected in that part of my personality and accepted and loved only when I was who she needed me to be, that good kid who could stay with her. And the message coming down is, all these negative feelings are wrong. They're no good. I will not be loved. As a matter of fact, I'm threatened to my very existence if I feel like this. That's how it would go with my mom. I was accepted not for what I was, but for what I did. Accepted for acting right, and acting right clearly included feeling right. And feeling right clearly for me did not include sorrow, tears, and anger. So these feelings are terrible. Now, I'm a little luckier than a lot of people I know in that I could feel anger. I wasn't given the privilege of acting or expressing it. I listened to one of my first Al-Anon fifth steps. The woman had been angry twice in her life, which means obviously she had suppressed all of her anger for years and years and years. Now, I could feel the anger, but I couldn't show it to you. If I had to confront you, if you're a secretary and something isn't done right, this is how extreme this goes, and I had to tell you about it, I could not tell you. I'd write it in a note. I could not give you the note. I'd wait until you were out of the office, run in, put it on your desk, and then run out. And then I would start shaking. And I used to think that this shake came from an adrenaline rush, until one day I had a real confrontation with a pastor. And it was a brief thing, but I said what I should have. It was good anger and it was healthy for me, and I knew that. I went back in my office and I was shaking. But what I was waiting for was the big hammer to come out of the sky and smash me. And I knew kind of the impression. I came up as a kid, confronted my mom, and, you know, I can't picture my dad doing that. That's how I know it'd have to be my mother. I mean, that would be how she would react. She'd have to crush it. There's going to be no rebellion in her household. So when I show anger, the tape inside, anger leads to the reaction, and I'm waiting for that reaction to come out of the sky. Despite everything I've said now, it's very important that we know that feelings are not just even neutral. That every feeling is precious. First, they're God created. I told you that. God looked at his universe, looked at you with all of your feelings, and he said, this is very whole. This is very good. This is the way you must be to be whole and entire and healthy as a person. Not to be this is to be not whole. It's to be fractured. It's to be split. It's to be not fully blessed as you are. I want to share something on this now. I've done this several times, and I'm going to do it again. For me, in sobriety, the weakest argument possible is to go to the Bible and use an example. What I've learned of the power of AA is that the most powerful thing is to go in and tell my own experience and share with you my experience and say, this is what I've experienced. This is what has helped me. And I'm saying this because I don't think this can be in ACA. I don't know if it's in Al-Anon, but it is certainly true already in AA. We're getting our AA fundamentalists who are doing this with the literature. They're reaching in. Somebody comes with a problem, and they take a quote out of context Or they take a quote and they slap it at the person and say, there's your answer. I never liked that with the Bible. Nobody has ever thrown a Bible phrase at me and caused me to change how I lived. And I react in my gut when I watch it done at an AA meeting, where somebody comes with a problem, they go into the book, they get a line out, and they, here's your answer. That is an Alcoholics Anonymous. It doesn't say we share our book's experience, strength, and hope. It says we share our experience, strength, and hope. And the great thing about AA is if you come with a problem, you might not know this. Really neat having here because I can talk about the technique. You know, if you feel you have a drinking problem and you come, you've had so much trouble, you got to confess and bare your breast to everybody else. You go to talk to an alcoholic in AA. Most of the time we shut you down and say, we don't want to hear about your drinking. Let me tell you about my drinking. And I start telling you about my drinking. You sit there wondering, how does he know how I feel? How does she know what I went through? How do they know about the hates, the broken promises, the hating yourself in the morning, the saying it's going to be different, and the broken resolutions again and again and again? And all of a sudden, I'm talking about me, and you're sitting there, and all of a sudden you know I'm not alone. Somebody else feels the feeling. That's where I've discovered how the book says in our literature, we won't want to shut the door on the past. We'll see that no matter how far down we've gone, our experience can be of benefit to others. Let me tell you how true that is for me. I'm as a codependent, I know severe depression, like a 9-month depression. And people will come to me who are depressed, and I just give them the description. I've come up with it, but I've never seen anyone who has known depression as a state who doesn't nod their head. My kind of depression is like you're in a fog where the air has like 9 ton of weight, and it's pressing down on you everywhere. And you know you're supposed to do something. You know exactly what you should do, and you don't have the strength to just get up and do it and move it. And I start sharing that with someone who is in the state of depression, and all of a sudden they know I understand where they're at. We heal by sharing experiences, not quotes. Then if I have the experience, then I can go to the book as I did with just now, saying no matter how far down we've gone, we see how our experience can be of benefit. I could stay up here and talk possibly for an hour showing how all the ways I screwed up in the past I've been able to use in sobriety as blessings, as aspirins or some kind of medication to help somebody who was walking through pain. And I'm freed of the emotional guilt. And I do say, I don't want to shut the door on the past. It's the biggest tool I have today to help heal other people, to go in and share my own pain. That's the AA way. But anyway, I started off with the Bible. You know, God said feelings are good. Now let me tell you, if you know anything about psychology first, feelings are automatic. We can't control them. They're responses of the body to protect, to preserve, and to strengthen life. An animal with no anger or fear could not survive in nature. No possible way. Say, unless it was an elephant. I don't know if elephants need anger or fear. They're just so big they can stomp on everything else. But anybody else, from the down from the elephant, these are instincts, and they show how precious life is. There's some threat to my life. Something is threatening me. Anger is an impulse that goes out to remove the threat to preserve life. Fear is an impulse to remove me from the threat to preserve life. They're God-built-in defenses that show the value of life, that how life screams to be lived and to be more and to be preserved. We need them. The same thing can be said of any and every other emotion. Circulating, as I shared with you, are the several books I have on codependency. I haven't read most of them. The one I'm reading is the one by Bradshaw. Bradshaw really, in several different sections of that book, will spotlight how healthy, I won't need it right now, but how healthy specific emotions are. Anger, fear, and he goes on. He talks about how healthy grieving is. It's a healing emotion. Grieving heals. It's sort of like a salve to heal our loss. And I watch families where there's no grieving. One of my best friend's brother killed himself. And the church they were in, the priest did not know what I've learned through this program. And the family didn't know it. It was a suicide, and the guy was in his early 20s. And the wake service and the Mass were the most joyful things in the world. There wasn't an ounce of grieving allowed in the ceremony. That family could not walk through their grief. I've learned how wonderful it is in the Catholic Church that we have a wake service and a funeral Mass. And I show people we have a double emotion as a Christian. Joy in our minds for what the dead person has got, that they're in heaven. If you really believe that Jesus did die for sinners, they're in heaven. But we also have grief at our own loss. And I go to show how Jesus cried at the tomb, to show how sacred this is. And I use the funeral Mass for the joy, the wake service to touch the sacredness of sorrow. And the purpose of my wake service is to get the family to cry. Because if the grief doesn't come out, that grief stays buried within, and it just acts on a person. Grieving is healing. It takes a whole year. If you don't know this, you can't short-circuit the grieving. You've got to go through everything that first time without the dead person. I tell you the story I was telling someone about the old man with the tear. First time I understood the sacredness of grief. I had a friend in AA whose wife died. And about a year and a half later, he and I were talking. And I asked him if he missed her. And a big tear came down his cheek. And this is the wisdom that comes from God. I looked at him and I said, I hope you never stop hurting. Because I knew for the first time in my life how beautiful true grieving is, true sorrow. That tear was the greatest tombstone that would ever be made for his wife. He was crying a year and a half later because he still missed the love that he got and the love that he could give. And when I said, hope you never stop hurting, which I was saying, I hope you never, ever come out of the experience of that love, the love you received and the love you want to give. And grief is so sacred and so beautiful. Sorrow is so wonderful. I'm a great believer and have been for years in self-pity. You hear it knocked in AA. You shouldn't be. I cut my body. I cut a finger. My finger's going to bleed. I believe bleeding is a primitive defense of the body to prevent blood poisoning. My bleeding will just wash out whatever impurities it can. It's not perfect, but it's the body's primitive way before a scab forms. I believe when I'm wounded emotionally, a scab can't form right away either. And I have a certain amount of self-pity that is very, very healthy and helpful for me to bleed. It depends upon the person. One of my first great AA speakers was a gal named Louise. She's from Memphis. And she said she would, if she had been hurt badly and you called her, she said, I'm on my pity pot right now. I'm not taking any calls. Call me back in 20 minutes. I wish I were as healthy as her. I need 3 days of self-pity for a bad loss. It takes at least 3 days. And you'll find your own time. I have got to sit there and nurse my wounds because nobody else is hurting enough for me. I got to hurt for myself. But at the time any of us come into our program, we're really lonely enough that we need self-pity. Certainly if you're an alcoholic or a drug addict. Certainly if you're a compulsive overeater. That's probably the absolute least sympathized with addiction. Nobody cries for you. You've got to cry for yourself. And someone has to cry for me. Since they're automatic, I cannot not have feelings. I can only accept them or stuff them. And a stuffed feeling, there's some beautiful little examples Bradshaw will talk about in there. Stuffing a feeling, one woman talks about, is like taking a bunch of hungry dogs and putting them down in the basement. They just get, and don't not feeding them, they just get wilder and wilder. Bradshaw has a much better example, because there's things about the hungry dog one I don't understand. Stuffing a feeling is like going out to a lake, a swimming pool, or the ocean with a big beach ball, and I don't want this feeling, so I'm going to hold it underwater. It is so tiresome and so difficult to balance it. I mean, I love that example when I thought about it. You know, I got that ball under there. I got to balance this feeling. I can't let it bubble up. I got to keep it down there. It just wears me out. It is so much healthier to just let the thing pop up and bobble on the water and not run my life. A stuffed feeling then is just so unhealthy for me. Now, let me just say, so you understand, there's a major difference between feeling and acting. Even when the action is wrong, the feeling is still okay. The feeling is good. I feel the anger. That's okay. I kick a kid. That's not okay. Okay? But even if I kick the kid, I don't damn the feeling because of the action. It's the action that was wrong, not the feeling. I believe it's wrong to act on anger to unnecessarily hurt someone. And I put the word unnecessarily in there. I think it has to be implied, like in the eighth step of AA when it says we made a list of all persons we had harmed. I think you've got to add unnecessarily. I know that I have badly hurt people's feelings. I've had people come to do a fifth step with me who have written their whole fourth step while they were using powder on pills. And I tell them I won't listen to it. I will die for your right to be in AA because there's only one requirement to be in AA, and that's you don't have to take a drink. But if you're on pills or doing pot, I'm almost guaranteed that you're going to go back to drinking, and I'm not going to be an accessory to your suicide. And the real power of the fourth step comes in my looking at what I've always run from. It's an inventory step where I look at me, if you don't know what we're talking about. I write out who I am on paper. And I can't get the healthiness of that if I'm drugged. I try to show them, you know, supposing a drug addict stayed drunk the whole time he did his fourth step. Do you think he'd do a fourth step? And they'll always say no, but they get angry at me. I've had people storm out hating me. I've hurt them badly, refusing to be part of their program, if their program includes unnecessary tranquilizers. And incidentally, if anybody is here who is psychotic, in no way does that include the tranquilizers to handle psychosis. They are absolutely different. They're not mood-changing. They're simply, they definitely do just affect chemicals in the brain. I've sponsored a drug addict who could never get enough of any other drug. And you have to talk him in, force him to take his drug for his psychosis because it made him act so normal. He'd never overdo it. It really does act differently. So I just want to put that footnote in so you don't have to have any guilt. But anyway, sometimes it's always good to have anger. First, having an anger tells me I have value. I just got this super good friend who was sober longer than me. And after knowing each other for about 5 years, she came to see me one day, all upset because she had had a big fight with her husband. And she was sure her program had collapsed. And all I did was sit there and congratulate her. I couldn't believe how much growth she had had. She had had two disastrous marriages. He was real rich. He gave her a superb home, all sorts of luxury. She was constantly feeling, I don't deserve this. And how could she, for years, she didn't feel she had enough self-worth to have a fight with him. If she fought with him first, she had enough self-worth to stand up and become angry. And secondly, she trusted the love enough to express the anger. That fight showed absolute deep growth on her part. A great friend of mine taught me 40 years in Al-Anon, said if a woman joins Al-Anon and things go better at home, she's not working Al-Anon. And there's a lot of wisdom to that, see. Al-Anons are doormats. That's my personality. I used to let people walk all over me. When a woman joins Al-Anon, she's going to learn she has rights, and she's going to start saying no. And the alcoholic isn't going to be happy. And things are not going to go as smoothly. So having enough worth, anger says I've got worth. It's wrong to let fear keep me from living. But it's good to have the fear. It shows I'm alert to a situation. The feelings are okay. My phrase is, if you're in the middle of an Oklahoma wheat field watching a tornado come right at you, you don't have any fear. That's not healthy. Not healthy at all. The fear can help me be alert to a situation. I prefer to use the terms helpful and harmful rather than good and evil. And it goes directly to my experience of God. For me, as I told you, I don't think you can put a list on the board and say this is how it absolutely has to be. For me, my God is love. And my God has given me this standard. Love one another as I have loved you. And love is acting to help a person. Hurt is acting to hurt a person. I mean, evil is acting to hurt a person. So love is being helpful. Evil is being harmful. And so the good question for me is this helpful? Is it harmful? It is helpful for me to feel my feelings. Under certain circumstances, it is harmful to act on those feelings, but the feelings themselves still stay helpful. Now, let me come into this problem I mentioned a moment ago, Jesus and anger. When Jesus says that anger is as bad as murder, first you got to know he's not dealing with absolute laws that are out here. And that's very important. Jesus said, the Sabbath, and here any law, because that's one of the Ten Commandments, the Sabbath is not, you are not made to match the Sabbath, to serve the Sabbath. You're not made. The Sabbath has been set up to serve you. So any rule is there to help you. The rules of religion aren't absolute guides. They're not the Anglo-Saxon laws we know. The whole Jewish way of looking at rules are different. We're dealing with people. We're dealing with us. Jesus is not dealing when he says, don't be angry. He's not dealing with the person you're angry at. He's dealing with you. Anger is a feeling that is so strong that when I have it, it blocks out God's love in me. And when I'm angry, I hurt myself. I say this and I mean it. The only thing that I think, if I made the universe, that I could do better than God is resentment. I think he's loused it up. You hurt me and I get angry. Now you hurt me and I get angry and the anger hurts me. When I heard Jesus say, turn the other cheek, I never understood that until once, after I was sober and got some inner peace and really enjoyed the peace, somebody hurt me and I was filled with resentment at 2 o'clock in the morning. And that's the day I understood what I'm sharing with you. First thing that occurred to me was, he hurt me and I'm not sleeping. I wanted to phone him so he would be awake and not being able to sleep also. But then I saw for the first time what is wrong with anger. It hurts me. And why Jesus said, turn the other cheek. And basically what he's saying is, okay, I have hurt you. Jesus says, I love you so much, I don't want you to hurt yourself now by nursing that anger. Flush what Larry has done and just look at my love. Handle the anger. Don't nurse the anger. Don't let that anger block out the love, because I want you to know the love. I love you. And you can't be filled with anger and be nursing love at the same time. So when Jesus says anger is as bad as murder, what he's saying, it doesn't make any difference if I act on it. If, for example, I hurt her, and for the next 3 years, well, give you the example. I had a bad scene with one of my archbishops. I think he really unnecessarily hurt me. The next 3 years, I drove around Oklahoma replaying that scene when I would be driving and just filled with anger until it occurred to me, he hurt me one afternoon. I hurt myself 3 years playing the tape. Because all the time I was playing the tape and playing the tape, like putting the tongue in the hole where the tooth had just been pulled out, I was bringing up that tape. My bishop didn't do that. He had nothing to do with that at all. That was just me. And all that time, I couldn't know love. Jesus is saying, doesn't make any difference I didn't kill the bishop. What I experienced for 3 years was just as damaging. For 3 years, Larry didn't know peace because Larry was filled with anger. Larry was filled with pain. So he tells me to do this so that I can handle the anger inside myself. There's one more real big error that's a difficulty in having our feelings for people in the program. And it's a very naive thought that if you're in the program and work in the program, you will always feel good. Or a second phrase of this, if you're in the program and working the program, you will be improving in your feelings. You will be feeling better. Oh, I like to tell you how there are certain, I think I told you how there are certain lies. The retreat tape on the 12th step, the last one I did, I go out of my way to puncture balloons of things you hear in AA that I believe are very badly wrong. They're not in the literature. One deadly one is keep coming back, it'll get better. Just don't drink. That is absolutely false and must be for a true alcoholic. If you take the alcohol out of the system, it'll get better briefly. But the topic I spoke to the doctors on at St. Elizabeth was you don't necessarily do an alcoholic a favor helping him stop drinking, because you leave just the naked alcoholism, codependency, whatever you want to call it, inner pain, inner fear that I couldn't live with. I'd have killed myself. I know today the most horrid thing, if you're a sober alcoholic here, if you got over 2 years, supposing for your sobriety, because you were threatening your life, someone had taken you to a treatment center and they had tied you down to a bed or locked you in a room, and that's all that had happened from the day of your sobriety to today. I'd have killed myself. Or in my case, I'd have gone paranoid into a psychosis. I could not live with this inner pain. I needed something to handle the alcoholism. First, it's impossible and wrong to think that an alcoholic working the program will always feel good. Feelings are automatic. They go up and down. They go in and out. You cannot emotionally always sustain a high. Highs are balanced by lows. It's sort of an action. The program deals with peace, not with feelings. We have in AA people who look at the big book exactly the way fundamentalist Christians look at the Bible. And they're taking every phrase as said literally true, and they think that literature cannot contradict itself. And I have three clear contradictions between the big book and the 12 and 12. When Bill wrote 15 years later, he clearly disagreed with three things he said. He comes up with a totally different way of doing an inventory in the 12 and 12. And he, in the big book, clearly says you get your list for your amends when you do your fourth step. In the 12 and 12, when he starts the eighth step, he said, we did a partial list of people we had harmed. Now the time comes to redouble our efforts and look. And in the 12 and 12, he clearly says you do a new list 15 years later. Either way is okay. See, if he did it two different ways, there's no one way to do it. And then in the big book, he says you get up in the morning, think through your day. If you don't have any, if you got some indecision, wait in meditation for an answer. 15 years later, he saw how a lot of people were becoming fanatics on that, see. Somebody who thinks God has told him to do this is a fanatic. And he saw damages. And he clearly, it's the second or the third to the last page in the 12 and 12 on meditation, on the 11th step, he clearly shoots that down and says, you better check anything you think is from God with someone else. That's not in the big book. Bill saw different things. And it's interesting to see how big book fundamentalists handle that. Sometimes they'll bend over backwards to try to show there's no contradiction, and there is. Or the easiest way is, the ones I know, they just flush the 12 and 12. And they say, one man wrote the 12 and 12 and 100 people wrote the big book, which really isn't true. One man wrote both books. Bill wrote the chapter to the wives. I hope you know that. Lois was really upset at that. An alcoholic who had no experience being a wife wrote the chapter to the wives in the big book. He wrote the whole thing. He sent it out for some corrections and suggestions, and they came in, but they weren't major. Bill wrote the big book. So the easiest thing is to see that, you know, well, this is what I want to come to. They're interesting books. I left this here because it's so fascinating. Somebody's doing this in Oklahoma, gave it to me as a gift. I had nothing to do with it. This is both the big book without the stories and the 12 and 12. You go to a printer, you take both books. They cut out the stories, but even the appendices are here. Bind them together, cut them because they're a different size, but they fit just so well, so I have both major books for the literature. It's very interesting. If you go to when Bill wrote the first book, the big book, Bill was on a 5-year high. He grooved on the attention. He was a wheeler dealer. He had come in. He had been sober. He had that blinding God experience, and everything was going great. And he wrote in here very naively, because it's in here, we positively insist on joy and happiness. People forget what happened next. Almost as soon as this book was done, Bill went, and he started a 10-year depression that he didn't know would ever end, and he wrote the 12 and 12. And it's an entirely different book. I would imagine most ACAs will find it much more grooving to read the 12 and 12 than the big book. See, Bill comes through. The 12 and 12 is so neat. Bill comes through with a step like 6, and he comes through with this net that has big holes like this and says, okay, we're going to look for faults. Let's look at the 7 biggies. Oh, you got through that one. Then he comes back with a second net. Oh, okay, we're going to catch you on a lot more things, and it's pretty hard to get through the second net. Then if you get through that one, he brings one this big, and ain't nobody gets through it. I mean, we all got defects. He talks about how long the list is of people we owe amends to. Huh? Should be, you know, just we go back and think, and just an unbelievable thing. Very analytical, the way those of us who are in depressions become. He would go to his office and stare at the wall for weeks. Couldn't do anything. He positively wasn't insisting on joy and happiness for 10 years. that goody-goody spirit was gone, and he walked through a lot of pain. There's different books and there's different views, so it's good to see that. Bill Wilson did not have a feeling good for from the year of almost like 40 to 50. Well, past 50, because he was still there when he wrote the second book. For being depression-prone, the most important sentence in AA literature for 3 years to about 8 years for me was a footnote in the book As Bill Sees It. I think it's on page 231 or 213. It's on one of those two. The footnote says, Bill wants everybody to know he has not had a depression since 1952. Most people miss how shocking that is. That's like 52. Now, we're talking about these severe depressions. So for 15 years after he had a blinding, 17 years after he had a blinding God experience, he was having severe depressions. 17 years after he wrote the steps, and while he was working with hundreds of alcoholics, he was still in severe depression. If it's okay for Bill, it's okay for me. That sentence validated my feelings. I can be depressed, not have to drink, and walk through the valley, and there can still be a light. It's okay to be depressed in the program. I want to go back to what I started with. If you're here depressed, I honestly, from all my experience and anything I've ever heard, I give you the permission to be depressed. It is okay to be depressed. If you're here, I would even congratulate you because you're depressed in here. That's more than I could do at times. Depression causes me to paralyze. Incidentally, I talked about how everything is good. I did a short course in a mental hospital when I was drinking. And one of the things I remembered that is so important today is any mental illness, the body claims because of the good that it's doing. You have one level of suffering, but a much deeper level of benefit. That's simple to point out with depression. Those of us who are depression-prone cannot feel anger. We cannot express anger. I get hurt, there's a threat. Anger comes, gets ready to come out. I can't express it, and it comes back in there as a paralyzing thing. Now, what has happened is something has hurt me, some situation. I've been scarred by life, and I go into a severe depression, and I'm sitting home alone in my chair, can't get up, can't get out. That's a lot of pain. But if you have no defenses against pain and you've just suffered a severe wound, that's the best the body can do from taking another wound that might be mortal right now. Depression's okay. It's the body trying in its own way often to protect life and show the value of life. What I have to do is get act to the contrary. I can't just stay depressed and stay in the chair forever, or I will. Sooner or later, I have to get up and I have to get out. But you can't feel good all the time. I can't. No one else can. Nor does someone who is healthy in the program always grow. People will feel that if they have a period of emotional unrest after serenity, all of a sudden their program isn't working. That isn't true. I go through different stages of growing, and different stages of growing will have different experiences connected with them. When I sobered up, I had the emotional growth of a 3-year-old. I got fired 9 years sober by some nuns teaching in a high school. And I know today that I got fired. It was good that I got fired. It was good I did what I did, and they had to fire me. I got fired because at that particular point, I was rebelling against all authority. 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 years sober, I didn't want any authority figure anywhere in the world except for my sponsor, thank God, to succeed. If things went nice for the Pope, I was angry. If the Pope flubbed, I was happy. If things went well for the President, I was furious. If the President fell on his face, I was delighted. Governor, mayor, any bishop, pastor, any authority figure, I was going through something I was never able to go through at home. I was going through that healthy stage when a teenager rebels against his parents or her parents. And that's good. That's becoming independent. That's a very healthy thing. Parents don't think so, but it's a very healthy thing if it's done right. The kid's got to rebel, and the parents have to be parents, and there's clashes and everything else, but the child is internalizing, I think, self-control. And went through it, and I was rebelling. I fought the law, and the law won and fired me. But the fight was good. And that's turmoil. You go from calmness to turmoil. A much better one is my first 3 years, as I share with people, I worked on defects. They were the defects that made me an SOB. From the third year on, for about the next 10 years, I worked on the defects that made me a nice guy. And of course, codependents can identify right away. I was a doormat. You could walk on me. I wasn't going to stand up for myself. You could cut me. You could make insults. Oh, just take it. Got to tell the codependent jokes. Got to get them on the tape. You know how many codependents, ACAs, it takes to change a light bulb? None. I'll just sit here in the dark. And my other one is description of an Al-Anon codependent relationship. An Al-Anon is someone hanging on a cross in tremendous pain, and they're not nailed on. Oh, but it hurts so good. I can't let go. It hurts so good. Just let go. You know, I'd start standing up for myself. I wasn't going to take the pain. You can hang on the cross and think you're a martyr. But if you're not nailed on, it may not be where God wants you to be martyred right now. It could pass so simply as good Christianity. And I had to teach myself to let go and confront. And we'll say, it's not right for you to say, talk to me that way. I don't have to take it. And the first time I said that, that's a tremendous sign of health. I would have the strength, when you needed it, to nail your hide to the wall for 5 hours in a fifth step to help you see what you needed to see. Now, that's turmoil. My gut would be churning all the time, but that's growth. Real growth doesn't mean constant serenity. True growth is a very scary thing. Right when I was still drinking, there were two tremendous posters. Al-Anon should look them both up. So should ACA, CODA, and all of them. One had a caterpillar, a cocoon, and a butterfly, and it said, choose. And the other had the cocoon and the butterfly, and the phrase was, you can fly, but that cocoon has to go. I can just picture how shattering it must be to leave the dark and the security of a cocoon for the blindness of the light. And there's got to be tremendous pain when it first happens. But it's the price of flying. And it's something we so much want to do. I believe it is crucial for you and me to know, therefore, that all of our feelings are precious. Others don't have to agree. When you start feeling your feelings, the people in your world aren't going to like you as much as they did. They will like you as that nice gal, that nice guy that you used to be. I've got to allow them to have their feelings, but I got to allow myself to be me. See, I cannot have two things. I cannot have your approval and be me at the same time. One must come before the other. And the one that, when I get healthier, I will be able to pick is, I must be me. Larry, I made you the way you are. I'm proud of you as you are today. Depressed, angry, scared, isolated, ready to grow, eager, joy-filled, whatever it is. And if anybody else out there, I want you to be proud of yourself too. And if anybody else out there doesn't like it, that's their problem, not yours. I need not approve all I do. Unconditional self-love is not unconditional approval. One of the neatest, greatest things my sponsor ever said to me, I called him up once, and I'd really done something lousy. I taught high school. The kids liked me. I wasn't fully emotionally grown, so I identified even younger with the kids. After they graduated, two kids drove 70 miles to where I was after I got fired. I took them to Lawton to a club, and they were about 19 years old, and they wanted a drink. So I, as a sober alcoholic, about 10 years, got a club card in this club, we were still a dry state, so they could have a drink and then drive back to Oklahoma City. And I didn't feel too good about that when I went to my AA meeting. And I still the next day called up my sponsor. I mean, that's how, at that time, how much I needed someone's approval. And told my sponsor what I did, and I said, I feel guilty. And what he said is, you deserve to. Now, what he said and how he said it are the important thing. The way he said it is, you're okay, what you did wasn't. Sometimes in the program, we almost feel we got to approve everything everybody does. No. No, that's deadly. I don't have to approve what you do, but I can never or should never not approve who you are. And the same thing with me. I don't have to approve everything Larry does is not good, but I shouldn't confuse what I do with who I am. If I act on anger, that's not good, but feeling the anger was good. And I shouldn't make the blur inside myself. That was wrong, but I'm still okay. That fight was wrong, but the anger was still okay, and I'm still okay. Therefore, as we wind this up, I need to work to see that all my emotions are precious. I advise, if you can't, take a little bit of time. Make a list of some things that I do to embrace my emotions. If I start feeling one, can I feel it through? Will I do what the AA literature says? This is by far the healthiest. When I'm in a feeling, write it out. I'm angry, write angry. I'm angry, write curses. You know, if you think you're mad, somebody has harmed you badly, and you think somebody is an effing fool, and you write they're a darn fool, that didn't work. It won't work. I just got a clue from Bradshaw's book in here. You really are mad with a childhood anger. I haven't done this yet. My therapist told me last time to write her a hate letter. And I did it. And somehow I knew I should print it. Bradshaw would say, if you really want to go back to the anger of a child, go to your weak hand. And it'll do it. It'll capture that childhood innocence and kind of do it. But write like a little mad kid. Be mad. It's okay. Write the feelings through. If I can't do either of these, will I pray to feel my feelings and to see them as good? Can I enjoy my highs? I've been talking mostly about negative feelings. Good feelings are every bit as good. And I should list some of the things I do to reject all the feelings that I have. Hating myself for getting tears. It's so funny now. For 10 years, I've been praying for the gift of tears. Never come for sorrow, but about 10 times in this 10 years, when I've been talking at AA conferences or once or twice in church, I'll start tearing up. You know what I say? Not God. Not now, God, later. I'm backing away still. I hate myself for the possibility of crying, or for losing my temper, or for feeling self-pity. Do I laugh at or scorn others for the feelings they have? That's a sign, you know, if I scorn you for your feelings, she's crying too much. He shouldn't be mad like that. If I laugh at your feelings, what I'm really doing is still trying to reject them in myself. So it'd be good to see, what am I doing right now? What am I doing so I know where I'm at? Inventories just show me where I'm at. There's no good or bad in that. I'm just inventorying. What am I doing to help my feelings feel? What am I doing to still suppress them? And then what's one thing I can do? One of the things will be to meditate, just to think of a loving God, whoever your loving authority figure is, looking at you today, and just he put the feelings in you, and wanting these feelings to come out. So much wanting these feelings to come out. God looking at you, and if you were a good little child, crying over that. To see that it's so sad. Oh, she's a good little girl. What a little adult she is. And to watch God cry about that, because a good little girl is not supposed to be a good little adult. A good little girl is supposed to be a wild little girl. A young little girl. A free little girl. And if your little girl was never free, to let that girl be free. To try, then, the meditation would be one. Sometimes, it's one thing you can do is try to encourage your feelings. If somebody has hurt you and you can't feel mad, we had to do this in the seminary, and this will work. We had to do it to learn to talk. Wad up a newspaper and just start hitting. You know. And if you don't feel anything, the actions, you're really feeling, and the actions are at least helping. What I tried to do to cry once was sitting on the floor and faking tears. Nothing ever happened, but I still felt a little bit better. Maybe meditate on Jesus having negative feelings, being angry, crying over Jerusalem, being flustered. Oh, those damn Pharisees. Why won't they see? And seeing the feelings are okay. It's the actions that are wrong. I want to go back now. There's two things I'll do, and we'll wrap this up. First, and say, remember, wherever you're at today, hey, it's just November. Remember the winter wheat. Just, what the hell? It's just November. If you can't feel your feelings, that's where God wants you today. Don't look at a friend who came here or hear me talk about some things and damn yourself because you haven't made the growth we have. You're not competing with us. You're the size you're supposed to be today for the wins in your life. See God liking you where you're at, but minimally wanting you to come up with feelings of being precious. Okay, there's one other thing came up. I don't know that it's come out in the talk. It'll be on some of the other tapes. You may never get to hear it. I want to share this. It's one of the things that I have had the most powerful discoveries on in my whole understanding of the program is making amends to people who are dead. Basically, it will take a whole year to do this. You have to work it through fully if you can go through the whole year grieving. If you can't, well, there'll still be some. You can do it then and come back later. It's going to be very important to talk about this. This will include if you've miscarried or aborted spontaneously or deliberately. I'm going to go into this in a moment. This is the biggest surprise of my life. In hearing fifth steps of women, people would come and they did 4, 5, and 8, and 9, and something was missing when they had had fetuses that didn't come to full termination. And from the Catholic viewpoint and some other things, I kind of said, you know, you have a child there, and your child wants a mother's love and a father's love, and that's what's incomplete. Your child's with God, and God is love, and your child wants to be able to love you, to be fully happy. Your kid's up there perfectly loved by God, but you're still not loving it. There's a little bit of sadness in your child's heart. So I suggest they go to the chapel and work it all through, and they came back, oh, countless people. And this has become so standard, it's a workshop now at two different Al-Anon meetings, one in Texas and one in Oklahoma. The women came back first and they told me that they knew the sex of every single fetus they aborted. I would call it now child, okay? Now, I could picture people reasoning that. I could picture 4 or 5 women coming up to the same conclusion. The next thing they came back with absolutely floored me, and it'll come up somewhere later. They knew a name for every child. Before you were formed in the womb, I called you by name. There is a name for every child. So they would work this through. And there would be peace. Let me come through the whole thing. First thing you do is you do 4. Take the dead person, and if anyone has died, I'm angry with them. I'm angry with them for dying. You know, if they suicided, they had an accident, the more traumatic the death, often the bigger the anger. Where there always is, I've discovered, or almost always, anger at death. Feelings are not reasonable. They don't have to suffer anymore, I do. Any other angers? Write all the angers out. Then, take a look at everything I've done wrong for this person and get both of those lists. Then do 1 of 3 things. I've never done the letter, so I can't talk about it. Either go to the grave or do meditative prayer. Picture you, the dead person, and the Lord, and start having a talk. And the first thing I do is I tell them off. I did this with my dad. And when I'm in my fourth step, I'm like a 3-year-old mad child in my picture. I just stomping and just yelling everything. And the dead person's with God. They can't feel any hurt, so you can't hurt them at all. So I got all the anger out, and then they asked me for forgiveness. And real reluctantly, because I knew I was going to have to make amends, I give it. Okay, damn it. Then I go through everything I've done wrong, and I ask for forgiveness. And feel the forgiveness. Now all that's in the book, and you could get that. So you do 4, asked for forgiveness and give it. Do 8, ask for forgiveness and hear them say it. Then, and this is the hardest of it all, give them permission to be dead. And that's the thing I've sort of stumbled on. It's the great freeing block. What that is you give them permission to be where God wants them, not where you want them. You would like them here on this earth in one way or another. You give them permission to be dead. I had somebody who suicided who was real close to me. I felt responsible for the suicide. Worked it all through and still had this block until finally I was able to give them permission to be dead. And now I'm free, very, very, very free. If If it's a child that died and you have never done this, also, you know, part of it, you just, part of the amends are, if you aborted, and spontaneously, I mean, deliberately, you say, okay, you know, I'll take some stuff for that. But the big thing is, you decide when you reach the end, it's not so much you give them permission to be dead, but more important, accept the role of mother or father. I will be your mother, and you can be my child from now on. And I have had women come back to me and say, from that day on, their children walk with them, and they ride with them. From now on, I'm going to be your mother, and I want you to love me all the time. And they have like two little angels, that's the way they picture, floating around with them wherever they go. From the time I gave my dad permission to be dead, my dad is with me in a loving way, always. Anytime I stop to think about him, he's right over here. And I never had his love ever that I knew when I was alive. I never felt it. But it's all worked through. This is real. I had a taper call me from Canada because he heard me talk about this. And after about a year, went out and did it and couldn't believe the results he had. The saddest thing for me is I tell my people this every month of November when Catholics are asked to pray for the dead. And I've never seen a member of my parish do it. And I know how much pain is there. You know, alcoholics and Al-Anons and ACAs and CODAs, we're desperate enough, we try it. You take the steps, you get the peace. It can really work. Okay?